Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News, and we're in-depth on why you may want to think twice about that tiara for your daughter. I got an email a couple of weeks ago from a listener who felt pretty ambivalent about taking her daughter to see Disney's new rendition of Beauty and the Beast. Lori wrote that she understand why her daughter identified so closely with princesses, but that she knew the movie would just deepen a perception that says beauty and sweetness and a kind of subtle entitlement that comes from that is what girls should be like. Researchers have found that the emphasis and marketing around princess stuff encourages girls to behave in stereotypically feminine patterns. So, with Beauty and the Beast out now and Disney's Cinderella on the horizon, we thought we'd hear what you have to say about the princess culture. And as our guests join us this morning, I'd like to know if you've been concerned about those princess movies and dolls that your daughter loves. Have you ever talked to your daughter or had a conversation with your friends about what the princess culture is communicating to your girls? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter. I see some of you tweeting about this. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Peggy Ornstein's with me in the studio. She's a journalist and a writer. She's written a number of books, including Cinderella Ate My Daughter. Her new book is titled Girls and Sex. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Great to be here, Carrie.
Rebecca Haynes is with us. She's an associate professor at Salem State University and the author of The Princess Problem. And Rebecca, welcome to you. It's good to have you here.
Thanks. It's so great to be here.
You know, Peggy, when I put this question out on Twitter about the princess culture, I heard from some parents who said, what's the big deal? So my daughter goes through a phase. She likes princesses. Now she likes trucks. Now she's interested in science. Why should I worry about this?
Well, you know, to me as a mom, and I started this project as a mother, my daughter was in preschool back then, and we had been raised. You know, I think, Carrie, when you have that little girl and you hold her in your arms, you think there's nothing you want her to have to do because she's a girl. There's nothing you want her not to be able to do because she's a girl. We were raising our daughter that way, going along, and then she hit preschool. And it was like How the Mighty Fall, right? And within 2 weeks, she had come home and she had memorized all the names and gown colors of the Disney princesses. And I had never even heard of that concept at that time. And I didn't know either. Was this, you know, a post-feminist celebration or was this a problem? And I think for me, what I came to was that it's part of it's so gigantic. And it's so all-consuming. It's like they have ice cream every day.
You mean the culture around princesses.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I availed myself of my mom's cast-off tiara now and again when I was a child. But
there
was not 3 straight years where I was supposed to not only pretend to be a princess exclusively, but be addressed as one. And you have to also look at what the track is that puts little girls on, because the marketing to children is so incredibly intense. Starts so young. And from the get-go, it's telling little girls that how they look is more important than who they are. And that's the problem.
Rebecca, I think what Peggy says about how enduring it is, the marketing around this and the idea of it and how all-encompassing it is different from what it was like when I was growing up as a kid.
It absolutely is. And even from when I was a kid in the 80s, I recall as a child growing up with a younger sister, we enjoyed the full range of Disney films characters. So we liked Pinocchio, we liked Snow White, we liked Mickey Mouse, we liked Donald Duck, and they were all sort of one big jumbo of the Disney creative concept, right? But now, girls are really narrowly directed into all princess all the time. And the loss of that diversity of imaginary friends, ideals, worlds is really unfortunate.
Anna says on Twitter, the youngest girls are put in a box of what femininity should be. I've seen flower girls at weddings called future brides by guests. Tiffany says, interesting that Belle from Beauty and the Beast sparked this. She's not a princess. She's a kind, hardworking bookworm. she should be a role model. I don't know. She's a princess, isn't she?
Well, so here's what's interesting is the story of how the Disney princesses came to be.
Right.
It used to be that these movies would come out and they would be out and there'd be a little merchandise around them. And then they would go, Disney would say, back in the vault. And they'd be there for 7 years. And then they would come out again. And a whole new group of children were out. And what changed was that there was a head of marketing who came into the company, head of licensing. And he went down to familiarize himself with the brand to an ice show in Phoenix. And he saw all these girls dressing as the characters. But they were using their imaginations. And you can't make any money off of that. So he went back and he invented this concept of Disney princesses. And he put these characters under one. And for a while, actually, he had Tinkerbell there. I mean, a number of them are not. Mulan's not really a princess. You know, it doesn't matter. They're under this rubric. And he put them. And it was really controversial within the company. My favorite story is actually that the old guard, led by Walt Disney's nephew, was against the princess concept because he said you couldn't take characters and market them separately from their movies and put them together on the same item. I don't know, the world would implode. I'm not sure what he thought would happen. But so the way that they get around that is if you look at any Disney princess item, you'll notice that all the characters are looking in slightly different directions. And that's because they're not supposed to know the other ones are there.
Wow.
But I think it has this other thing of like, God forbid Cinderella should give Belle a little support, you know? She doesn't know she's there. So it's sort of this almost anti-female friendship in a certain way.
Rebecca, I think this is interesting too, because what Peggy said about the imagination and that being the debate inside Disney, because the other thing that these movies and the marketing do is create kind of a parameter, an ideal, right, of what a princess is. And it really doesn't say, be a princess in any way you want to be. That's probably also different than how it was when I was growing up and imagining myself as a princess.
That's right. And what we see happening is that, you know, Disney Studios understands that their characters need to be more dynamic and more empowered. So you're seeing characters like Anna and Elsa, like Moana, all coming out with these really cool characteristics. But ultimately, when Disney Consumer Products Division gets their hands on these characters and are trying to market them in a synergistic way, they all sort of regress back to the mean. And what is the mean? If you go back to the earliest princesses, it's pretty pink, frilly,
right,
sparkles.
Right.
So even if you've got on-screen characters that girls love who are better role models, and I would say, you know, when Beauty and the Beast was first released, Belle was a bit revolutionary. Having a feminine character who loved books and reading was more intelligent than the men around her for like the early 90s was actually kind of revolutionary. But I've never seen a Belle's book playset, and I researched this carefully. All I can find are, you know, Belle's makeup kits and items featuring her dressed as girly as possible.
Rebecca, if it's that subtle, I mean, did you really have to look that hard for it? I'm assuming that the message is missed by a lot of the girls and maybe even their parents themselves.
I think so. And, you know, the parents are onto it. But no, the girls, I mean, kids do watch movies on repeat. But let's think about how the merchandise plays a role in their lives.
Right.
They fill their rooms with these toys that all have that same narrowly constructed beauty ideal. They sleep with these toys. They wear the costumes. They want to wear the costumes to go to the grocery store. They imagine that they, too, are little princesses. And they're not imagining themselves as, like, girl power, butt-kicking action-adventure princesses. They are falling into line with this very stereotypically heteronormative feminine beauty myth.
This is a conversation, if you've just tuned in, about the princess culture revived because Cinderella is coming from Disney soon, and they've just released Beauty and the Beast. Peggy Ornstein is in town and in the studio with me, and she's written about this in a book called Cinderella Ate My Daughter. Her new book is titled Girls and Sex, and Rebecca Haynes is with us, and she's an associate professor at Salem State University and the author of The Princess Problem. And I'm asking you as parents, as you listen into this, if you've been concerned about the princess movies and the dolls and the marketing and maybe the messaging to your daughters and sons, by the way, I really shouldn't eliminate the effect on boys here. Have you ever talked to your daughter or sons about, or maybe with your friends, about what the princess culture really says to your kids? 800-242-2828 651-227-6000 on Twitter here at Carrie NPR trying to keep up. Kelly says, as a mom of a five-year-old girl, I've been encouraged by the new princess models, Moana and Elsa, which are very empowering and strong. Another listener says, we kept all things princess away from our girls. We did Tinkerbell because she solved her own problems and was about friendship. And then Sean says, my 10-year-old daughter says, I'm glad they don't find someone to marry in every princess movie. To the phones, to Cowley in St. Paul. Hey, hi. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to share two thoughts. One is that, you know, my girls are older now. They're 17 and 13, but when they were little, we didn't really watch any TV. That was a rule in our house, no TV. But yet they were very ingrained with this princess culture anyways by everybody else around them, at school, everywhere that they went. And I often worried about the impact that this had on them and their own power. And so I was very worried, but I let it play out. And I, you know, my younger one used to wear a princess dress. She had every single one from other people for birthdays. She would wear one every single day, everywhere we went. And she always, I could see that she was trying to act like them. And it worried me. But then, you know, now they both really, they grew out of it. My girls are tomboys. They're like athletes. They wear sweats and you know, track suits all the time. And they talk about their own empowerment. And they took away the things that they liked that they thought were beautiful and strong about those princesses. But it doesn't really play out in their lives now. And so I guess I wondered, do we worry too much early on, and how does that impact them? And I also think about maybe how did we influence them, because we often talked about how images in the movie versus what we were seeing in marketing pieces. And so I don't know. I guess it's such a mixed bag, and it's really hard as a parent to say what do you let play out and then what really does influence your child that has a permanent effect on them, because my girls never wear dresses today unless they absolutely have to.
Good question here. Peggy, what would you say to that?
Well, I think you hit a really important point, which is the way that you talk to your daughters about that and the way that you developed a critique within them. Because, yeah, my daughter's 13 also now, and she has a pretty strong critique of all of this. But I would also say, if you look at the marketing culture to girls, starting at that young age, it goes from that, you know, seemingly innocent princess industrial complex kind of pink and pretty play to then they're supposed to move on to a kind of sassy girls with a Z, which I think if you see that, you're always in trouble. And, you know, sassy is like sort of sexy with training wheels. And then what was interesting to me in moving on with my current book, which is Girls and Sex, was looking at the way that that marketing then turned to the marketing of hot to girls as this narrow, very commercialized, frankly unimaginative idea of sexy that is foisted upon them over and over and tells them again that how their body looks to other people is more important than how they understand and enjoy and experience that body themselves. So I think that the concern that I had and that we see playing out in the research, frankly, it's not just an anecdotal concern, is that those ideas about body, those ideas about beauty become skewed and distorted and stay that way as young women get older.
Yeah, what I hear, Peggy, here is it isn't princess's destiny. Your daughter is destined to grow up and
right. Very
still
few
always
girls
love
are swanning off to college in their bell gowns. It's true.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it is a strong impression of what femininity looks like that can crowd out a lot of other images.
Exactly.
Of femininity.
So, and when, you know, traditionally, toys have communicated adult expectations to kids. So when I was young, girls had baby buggies and baby dolls and Susie Homemaker.
Yeah.
Boys used to have erector sets. And, you know, that has changed. It got in the 60s. It was very confused. Nobody knew. You know, and now we're back to what are we communicating with the toys that are geared at girls about what it means to be female?
Rebecca, would you say something about the marketing of toys that speaks right to what Peggy's just brought up?
Well, you know, one thought that comes to mind is several years ago, the American Psychological Association actually released a white paper on the sexualization of girls, and they were very concerned with the way that girls are taught to do just what Peggy said she sees happen and the research bears out regarding princess culture, to see themselves as objects that are there for another person's viewing pleasure. And the American Psychological Association implicated children's culture, including toys, in this problem. So when the toys are really image-oriented in the way that princess culture toys are, you do have to do like the last caller mentioned she did with her girls and talk about what's on screen versus, you know, real life ideals. There's a good body of literature on a concept called parental mediation that suggests that when parents sit and co-view with their children what's on screen and talk about it, talk back to the screen and say to the kids, you know, they really focus on how beautiful she is in that song, but do you think that's the most important thing about Belle? Right? Is that what makes her who she is, or is it what's on the inside? Kids will take away their parents' values if you look at what's happening in the toys, look at what's happening on screen, and openly interrogate that and help the kids develop that critical thinking apparatus.
Call here from Jackie in Minneapolis. Hi, Jackie. Good to have you call.
Hi. I'm a psychologist and a mother of three young girls, ages 1, 2, and 4. Mm-hmm. And so we have a lot of princess going on in our home. And I do struggle with how to negotiate some of these images and stereotypes and the whole idea of princess culture. I think what we've tried to do, though, is really, you know, show the movies briefly or one or two times and then focus on the soundtracks and the music. And my kids really enjoy dressing up, whether it's in princess outfits or my own old dance costumes, but dance around and really kind of use that to feel that in their body. And so I'm trying to get them to enjoy that as, you know, the music moving them and feeling empowered and strong in relating to those characters. And also retelling those stories of Moana and even Snow White and focusing on just what your callers are saying, the personal qualities of each of those characters, being brave or overcoming things that were scary or things like that. So we're trying to mediate that, but I also really don't want to diminish the joy that I just see that it brings them.
And that I think that is really the dilemma of the tone here, right? You don't want to crush the fun that
they're having. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. You know, I always say that you need to fight fun with fun. Because if you think that you're going to give your daughter a broader idea of what it means to be female, what it means to be feminine, what it means to be a woman by saying no all the time, you have another thing coming. So for me, as a parent of when I was the parent of a younger child, and still, because it's not like it's going to get easier when she's a teenager, let me tell you right now.
As you're learning.
you know, and in fact, I think you build that scaffolding in this practice with younger children is thinking about what else you can offer them that broadens that idea of what it means to be female. So we did a lot of Miyazaki movies like My Neighbor Totoro and Kiki's Delivery Service, which are fantastic. We, you know, rather than princess dresses, which P.S. have a sell-by date, and the day your daughter turns 5 or 6 or whatever it is, they are out the window, and whatever money you spent, it's over. You know, we had like sort of silks. There was something called Sarah's Silks that we would use, and those things lasted for many years because they became school projects. They became, you know, building tools. They became all kind, you know, things that allowed open-ended play that she could use her imagination with. And we did a lot of Laura Ingalls Wilder. You know, there's a lot of things that you can do. You can go to the site A Mighty Girl. They have all kinds of suggestions for
things. Is that amightygirl.com?
Amightygirl.com. Okay. Isn't it, Rebecca? Is that right?
Oh, I'm not sure off the top of my head. I see them on Facebook all the time. They're great.
Yeah.
Rebecca, John says on Twitter, and we're hearing from a lot of dads, which is great. As the father of 16-year-old and 9-month girls, I resist princess culture, but I find that girls still watch their parents closer than cartoons. How do dads reinforce what you both have been saying today? Because, boy, are they deeply influential in the way that girls will see themselves.
They are. You know, how dads relate to their daughters really does set the tone for how girls will expect to be treated by the men with whom they have romantic relationships later in life. So if the dad is always, oh, you're my pretty princess, oh, you're so pretty, and is really appearance-oriented, it's setting the girl up into that feedback loop where she needs that external validation of her worth in terms of physical beauty. But if you have a dad who is affirming of who she is, who is embracing her interests, whatever they may be, and helping her engage in her interest in princess, should she have that, in a more open-ended way, that can be really great. For example, there was one dad that I interviewed in my research whose experiences with his daughter really stood out to me. he would sit down on the floor and play princesses with her, but also pull out like G.I. Joe toys and say, oh, the princesses have to fight the fire in the castle and rescue the G.I. Joe dolls.
Smart.
And just sort of upend the stereotypical narratives and show that he approves, right, of the idea that girls can do powerful things that you might not assume they could do when wearing a frilly dress.
Shaylee says on Twitter, love the discussion of co-watching and interrogating culture. I do this with my nieces and nephews, and it encourages early critical thinking. Nick says, took my two-year-old daughter to Moana. She spent most of the movie with her fist in the air as Moana saved the world. So good to see. Does Moana save the world?
Yeah, kind of.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that good role model then. But she's a princess or no?
She's a chief's daughter.
Is she a Hawaiian? Okay.
Yeah.
A Hawaiian chief's daughter. Okay. To someone who'd like to be anonymous in Minneapolis, hi.
Good morning.
Hi.
I am a Disney Store cast member in the Twin Cities, and I just want to give a different perspective from when people walk in our store. Some people let their kids go wherever they want to go, and they just kind of follow them. Sometimes you'll have parents who, you know, they'll go, little boys will want to run towards the princess stuff and like, no, that's the girl's side of the store. You need to go this way to the boy's side of the store. Or you have girls who want to go over to the boy's side and no, you got to go to the girl's side. And, you know, I've seen parents give kids free reign. I've had little boys try on princess dresses in our store and play and have a wonderful experience. I've seen parents let their kids go and, you know, they want to have a little girl wants to have an adventure with Star Wars and Princess Leia or Rey, or, you know, the boys want to go and have an adventure with Tinkerbell and Neverland. I really think sometimes it's what the parents are steering the children towards and how they accept these characters.
Boy, I
what dad doesn't want his little boy to go to Neverland and have an adventure and fight the pirates? But Peter Pan's best friend was a girl. Kind of skews things. And, you know, you've got the girls with, you know, they're people like Anna with Kristoff. She's got a guy helping her, but she's doing most of the work. But the person who's along for the journey is a guy. So sometimes it's how the parents hear the kids and interpret the narrative themselves.
Did you say you play a character in the Disney store? Is that right?
No, I just work for Disney.
You work there. Okay. So you've been able to observe how parents behave in the store. Peggy, what do you think of that?
Well, I think she brings up so many interesting points, including that when girls do something that we think of as being assigned to boys or as assigned to men, we tend to encourage it and think that that's sort of almost reaching up.
Yeah, that's
whereas
right.
Whereas when boys do something that we associate with the feminine, we discourage it because we almost think about it as reaching down. And that's something to really pay attention to for parents, too, because, you know, one thing that we know is that when kids play across gender lines, that those friendships are really important, not only for learning the ways and the things that are assigned typically to either sex, but also over the long haul, kids who have cross-sex friendships when they're young and can retain those friendships have better romantic relationships later on. Mm. So when we have our kids in these gender boxes, it's very hard to reach across those lines and have cross-sex friendships.
You're working on a book about boys, right?
I am working on a book
about
boys.
You are steeped
now
in this research at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Call here for you, Rebecca, from Mike in Maple Grove. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
I just want to say I'm
a father of a few girls, and I always express that the princess is on the step toward being a queen, and that queens help rule their lands, and that we looked at the Queen of England as being a representative, and how they have to look at the economy and the welfare of their people, and that it wasn't just all the fun stuff, and that they had to understand science and had to understand all the things to make their land successful, and they also. They can rule with the king, and sometimes if the king passes away, the queen is the top of the totem pole.
I'm feeling a little ambivalent about this, Rebecca. How about you?
You know, I think that there is something to be said for grounding the fantasy idea of princesses in actual historical reality, right? Because in reality, a princess is a political sort of position who might have some varying degree of power, may or may not become a queen. It really depends on the structure. But I do think that, you know, going back and looking at histories of women who were actual princesses and actual queens is a nice way to broaden things out a little bit. It might be a good transition away from the really stereotypical Disney fantasy princesses towards maybe an interest in history that then you take a step to the left and you say, and here's Joan of Arc and what she did.
And here's the prime minister of the...
Right.
I mean, you know, Mike, the reason I said I'm feeling ambivalent, and this is probably not fair to Mike, but I was like, get right to the prime ministers, the women who have... But I hear what you're saying, Rebecca and Peggy, step by step by step and making it kind of a natural transition.
And, you know, I also would just like to say that girls need to see it to be it, you know? Mm-hmm. So girls need to see a broad range, and they don't right now in our media and in our culture. But one thing that was really interesting is that the percentage of girls in archery competitions mm-hmm. has shot up in recent
right?
years. And they directly link that to...
Because of the princesses?
Because of Merida in Brave and Katniss
Got
Everdeen.
It. Okay, in the Hunger Games.
Hunger Games.
Yeah.
And it has had a direct...
Wow.
Direct impact on girls' participation in archery. So if you can see something that direct from that kind of change, you can imagine what kind of change we could make.
Peggy Ornstein with us. If you've just tuned in to the show, she wrote Cinderella Ate My Daughter, and we're talking a bit about the princess culture with Disney's Beauty and the Beast out. And there's been a lot of discussion about this going on Twitter. And Rebecca Haynes is with us. She's an associate professor at Salem State University and the author of The Princess Problem. Call here from Elise in Mendota Heights. Hey, Elise. Hi.
Hi, Carrie. I'm really excited to be talking to Peggy today. Peggy, your book, Girls and Sex, has been a hugely valuable tool. My daughter now is 16. We have made it through the princess stage, but now I am trying to figure out how to navigate through the culture of pornography, social media, in her teenage years. And your book has been a really nice tool to help me figure out how I start to have that conversation. It's really an excellent read and really enlightening. My question is, you know, how and when do I start having these talks with my daughter? And furthermore, I know you're going to be in town on Friday. I plan on attending your event, but do you think that's an appropriate place? Do you think this is appropriate for me to bring my 16-year-old to this event on Friday?
Yeah, actually I do. And, you know, I think this is what I was saying earlier, is that I think that starting these conversations, you start the conversation whenever you can start the conversation, but by starting some of these conversations young, even in a way before kids can sort of understand what you're saying, or, you know, when you're saying like, look, her eyes are bigger than her wrist. Are your eyes bigger than your wrists, honey? You know, that you're building this scaffolding of discussion with your child about media and about femininity and about these issues that then you can bridge into discussions about sex. So, yes, I would say absolutely a 16-year-old. I would also say, you know, one thing, I did a TED Talk that's up right now on girls and sex, and you can just search for it. And watching that with a daughter, or happening to have on one of the radio programs that I did in the car where she can't get out, and listening to it and saying, you know, not so much, you know, what's going on with you, but sort of, what do you think about what she's saying? What's going on in your world around these issues? Is this something you're seeing with your friends? Is a way to have an inroad into that conversation and put yourself out as an askable parent and as somebody that can talk to your daughter about these issues.
Okay. And that event, because I've got a tweeted question about that, is it, yeah, is it 7 o'clock with me at the Mall of America, Peggy Ornstein there. To the phones here to Tyson in Minneapolis. Hey, hi. Thank you so much for waiting.
Yes. Hello. I'm calling. I'm the parent of preschool boys, and in playing with them, it's very apparent to me that there is a vocational nature towards the programming that is targeted to them. I happen to work in construction, so it's easy for me to engage in trucks and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I think through, if I had a daughter trying to engage in something that's purely fantasy and is not correlated to my notion of what it means to be a strong woman in reality, seems to be a very apparent and how do you cross that fantasy versus reality divide in playing with young girls?
Yeah, this is
what would I do for my son?
We only have a couple minutes left, and I want to give Rebecca a chance to flesh that out a little bit. Rebecca, what would you say? It's a really good question.
You know, I think that activities are something that we can really look at as a way to engage girls physically. You know, there's studies that show that girls actually don't feel comfortable using their bodies in the same way that boys do. And I think it does come down to the fantasy versus reality divide that she was just mentioning. So, for example, get your girls at a young age playing t-ball or soccer or dance or take them to a painting class. Doing things physically rather than just being in that fantasy world is a good step in the right direction.
On Twitter here, a listener says, Mira, spot on, sexist ideas of kids' gender, non-stereotypical behaviors treated as reaching up and down based on child's assigned gender. This is really interesting what you said, though, about the way boys are. I mean, and I'm sure that's never explicitly said, Peggy, within the family, that if you want to do the stuff that girls like to do, that's just not worthy of you.
Right. And then
what
happens?
Parents communicate that in a lot of different ways.
And what happens as boys get older, the biggest insult they can hurl at one another is you're acting like a girl or using some profane word that reduces girls to their genitals or talks about boys' homosexuality as equating with feminine or all. You know, there's it continues to degrade femininity, degrade girls in these subtle and sometimes explicit ways that then, again, you know, they get to their relationships, their romantic relationships. How does that play in? How does that happen? What does that mean about how they see women in the workplace? What does that mean about how they see women in the classroom? And, you know, there is research that shows, what does it mean about how we see women leaders and how we stigmatize women leaders? We do teach boys that the feminine is lesser.
Rebecca, has Hollywood, have the toy companies responded to much of what we're talking about? I mean, this has been in discussion for some time.
It has been. I will say that after some pressure last year, the toy industry removed, they ended the Girl Toy and Boy Toy of the Year award.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Really. Wow. That was newsworthy. This was the first year that wasn't in effect. So, you know, sustained pressure from concerned parents and critics who do have children's best interests at heart can affect change, but it's something to continue watching to see if that's going to really shift the types of toys that the manufacturers are producing and marketing.
Rebecca, really good to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Rebecca Haynes is the author of The Princess Problem. Peggy, I will see you at 7 o'clock at the Mall of America on Friday. Thank you.
Thank you.
For
see
being
you
here. She's the author of Cinderella Ate My Daughter, and the new book is titled Girls and Sex. Hey, more information. If you just got in on the conversation a little late in the game, you can find it on my podcast. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller. Just a little change, small to say the least, both a little scared, neither one prepared. Beauty and the Beast.
Looking for a new podcast? I'm Tracy Mumford, a producer for NPR News. I'm part of the team working on 74 Seconds. It's a new podcast that looks at the shooting death of Philando Castile by Officer Geronimo Yanez. It happened last summer in Falcon Heights, Minnesota. Yanez is now facing charges in Castile's death. 74 Seconds looks at what happened that night and what happens now when a police officer goes on trial. Reporters John Collins and Reham Fashir will walk you through this case as it unfolds. It's a story about race, policing, and justice in America. Subscribe to 74 Seconds wherever you get your podcasts.